America today, we have more income and wealth inequality than we've ever had. People on top doing phenomenally well, middle class struggling, lower income people really facing desperate times. And you don't do deficit reduction in any moral sense on the backs of some of the people in this country who are barely making it right now.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders this morning on MSNBC explaining why he'll vote no on the debt ceiling deal. It passed the House late yesterday with bipartisan support and is now up for debate in the Senate. It had plenty of opponents. More than 100 House members voted against it. Most of the no votes were from ultra-conservative Republicans who said the deal didn't go far enough to cut spending. But dozens of progressive Democrats voted against it, too. They don't like that. The deal imposes more work requirements for some people on food stamps, and the pause on student loan repayments would end in August. Here to talk about the progressive opposition to the debt deal is Jennifer Habercorn. She covers the White House and Congress for Politico. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's first talk about student loan forgiveness. So this bill requires the president to end the current pause, which was a pandemic pause on student loan repayments by late August. But wasn't he going to do that anyway?
Well, the issue has been tied up in the courts. So it's so once that is sorted out, there was this question as to what the president was going to do. And this is trying to just get a little more time so that the courts, before the courts act.
Right. This is on the actual forgiveness of student loans. But in terms of the pause on student loan repayments, is that a separate thing, or is that also tied up with the court case?
That's tied up with the courts.
I see. Okay. So that's one thing that progressives are not in favor of. What else are they angry about?
Well, their chief frustration is that there was negotiation over the debt limit in the first place. They feel like the White House kind of made a mistake in starting this negotiation. They feel like now that they've done it once, they're going to have to do it again in the future. And this is going to become another huge leverage point for Republicans. But there's also policy in there that they don't like. There's some frustration with the Mountain Valley Pipeline, which is a oil pipeline in West Virginia that got approved. There's frustration with the amount of spending that is going to have to be cut because of this. So there wasn't, frankly, much for them to love in this bill at all.
Mm-hmm. And so some progressives in the House said that they would vote no. And is that what they cited? They cited what you just said, the climate provisions and the work requirements?
Yeah, but you know, like I said, they didn't really like anything in this legislation besides that it raised the debt ceiling. So there was also about a $20 billion cut in IRS funding that was approved previously that has been removed from this bill. So they didn't like that either. Just a lot of things that frustrated them.
Uh-huh. And so I'm wondering, though, if they knew this would pass anyway, and so they could vote their conscience with a clear conscience, if you will, that they weren't going to torpedo the economy.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of hope that the bill passed, but frustration with it. And some of those people decided to vote for it because they didn't want to kind of ditch the president when he had to cut this deal. But then there were others who chose to vote no anyway. But certainly on the progressive side, no one liked the legislation. And what they actually decided to do when they had their voting card on the House floor, they were somewhat divided.
Is there anything they can do now, now that this has passed the House and is likely to pass the Senate and be signed by the president? Is there anything they can do to ameliorate what they don't like going forward?
Not a whole lot. There certainly is a lot of discussion about how to prevent this in the future by using the 14th Amendment to take the debt ceiling off the table so that it's not a future point of negotiation. There is already some chatter about ensuring that some of the spending cuts in the future can be averted. The bill kind of set up a mechanism that in the future, if the two parties can't agree on a spending bill, there's an automatic cut that goes into place. So there's already talk about how to prevent that. But otherwise, there's not a whole lot that they can do, at least not a whole lot that they're willing to do. You know, they could have voted no, they could have tried to stop this, but you know, in a lot of progressives' eyes, the risk of default was greater than anything that was in the bill.
Right. And also from a political standpoint, this is we're heading into the re-election campaign for the president. And I guess they didn't want that hanging on his neck, that the, you know, if the economy went off the rails, that a lot of voters would blame the president.
Yeah, exactly. And that was a huge risk that they were unwilling to take. And one of the things this bill does is it does push a future debt ceiling fight until after the 24 election. The next debt ceiling would have to be raised in January of 25 at the earliest. And so they felt like that was a pretty important political win, that they don't have to come back and do this again in 6 months or a year.
Why not just get rid of the debt ceiling entirely? Other countries don't have it.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And that's something that progressives are, I'm hearing a lot of that from progressives. And so that's why they are talking about how to avoid this in the future. There's some talk that the 14th Amendment, which says that the full faith and credit of the United States government shall not be questioned, can be used here, and that the debt ceiling is kind of a fiction because Congress approved all the bills that created the spending that created this debt. And so to even have a debt ceiling doesn't really make sense, because if the president decided, okay, we're going to default, is he going to decide between, you know, which bills passed by Congress? His job as the executive is to, you know, pass enact the laws passed by Congress. So kind of a wonky debate, but one that I think a lot of progressives are going to be pushing the White House to have.
What about these work requirements that we touched on for food stamps? It increases the age to up to 54 instead of the current 50, and basically says that almost everyone who receives these benefits needs to work. It doesn't change the actual rules, but it just increases the age by 4 years. Why was that so vehemently opposed by progressives?
Yeah, so this was a challenging point for a lot of progressives who said that, you know, our government benefits shouldn't be contingent on these work requirements, and that people in this age range, 50 to 54, who make low enough income that they even qualify for these benefits, are often people who, have challenges obtaining work. And they just felt philosophically that government benefits for as little as $6 a day to afford food shouldn't come with these contingencies. And they felt like if they start opening the door to work requirements in any fashion, that Republicans are going to take advantage of that and try to push it even more in the future. And so that was a big policy that progressives felt like shouldn't have been part of the debt discussion in the first place. And then they opposed it entirely. Interestingly, the White House responded and added an exception and said veterans and people experiencing homelessness would not face any work requirements at all. And the Congressional Budget Office, which calculates how much bills are going to cost and how many people are going to be impacted by them, actually found that the White House's policy and the Republican policy are almost a wash in terms of the total number of people that would be affected by work requirements.
Mm. All right. Well, thank you so much for the update.
It's great to talk with you.
You too. That's Jennifer Habercorn, reporter for Politico, where she covers the White House and Capitol Hill. All right. Happy June 1st. Happy new month, and happy, well, it's a little bit of a gray day, but we're going to try to coax the sun to come out. And while we are doing that, we're going to ask you to do your part to help us here at KCRW. Keep the lights on. Keep the sun shining. We're having an emergency fundraiser. We're calling it SOS Save Our Summer. And maybe because you are news junkies and you love the news, you have heard that other public media organizations are having problems, and other media organizations in general are having problems. Some are going out of business entirely because of the economy and shifts in how people consume the news. So we do not want that to happen here at KCRW. We're not in imminent danger of default, if you will. But perhaps we need to raise our own debt ceiling here. 800-600-5279, kcrw.com/join. Any amount is welcome, any amount at all. And do it today for a huge bonus, because if you commit to giving monthly by midnight tonight, and you're one of the first 73 members, you will unlock an additional $300 for KCRW. So each person who donates as a monthly member will give us an extra $300. And that's thanks to the KCRW Champions Fund. So go to kcrw.com/give. And thank you for your support to save our summer. Coming up, is artificial intelligence an existential threat to Hollywood writers? We're going to talk about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Hollywood scripts have made computers do everything. They've sent Terminators back in time to kill humans, and also made a lonely Joaquin Phoenix fall in love with them. Now screenwriters are living through a high-stakes premise themselves. What if artificial intelligence replaced them? It's a growing threat faced by writers, and one of the points of contention in the current Writers Guild strike against Hollywood companies. Scott Myers has been a Writers Guild member since 1987 and is a professor of screenwriting at DePaul University in Chicago. He also writes the blog Go Into the Story for the Blacklist website. Scott, welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how worried are you about AI replacing screenwriters?
10 plus.
Really?
I think it's more of a concern about what the people on the other side, the producers, the studios and networks, what they feel AI is capable of. My testing of it, and I've done that on my blog, a series of tests on ChatGPT, suggests that it's nowhere near replacing writers. But I think that they, the suits, believe that it can eventually. And so that concerns me, yes.
What do the suits think that AI can do that would let it replace writers?
Well, I think they're already in a position where they're doing it. They think that, for example, they can use AI to take pre-existing content or content that's in the public domain and have AI create a treatment or even a really bad script, a full-fledged screenplay, and then hand that over to a screenwriter and say, okay, humanize this.
Hmm.
And I think that's one of the concerns of the, that is a major concern in the strike, is that that's what's happening behind closed doors right now. You can tell from the AMPTP's response about that negotiating point, they weren't even willing to talk about it. They said, we'll have meetings every year to talk about this sort of technology. So that does concern me.
Well, conversely, couldn't writers do that if they're pitching a script, have an AI work up a treatment and then humanize it and then pitch it?
Actually, everything before fade in, before you actually start the page writing process, I feel that AI can benefit writers. I'm working with undergraduate and graduate students now where they're using AI for story ideation, coming up with story concepts, with character development, with brainstorming. And so it can be a very helpful tool. And I know many of my screenwriting cohorts use it in that regard. The problem is when they then say, all right, let's go to page and see what we can come up with, because that really gets dicey in terms of the authorship and what they will then do to minimize the role of the writers in the process.
From the point of view of a consumer, a watcher, it sometimes feels that AI has written scripts when you watch something that's really formulaic. I don't know, like a police procedural or a soap opera. It just feels like a computer wrote it, and that's been a complaint for a long time. So I guess from the point of view of a consumer watching just basic stuff, what's the difference?
That's a good point. I think that we've seen in the last 20 years, the movie studios and networks have been, with all the prequels and sequels and remakes and reboots, essentially training audiences to accept what are in effect regurgitated content, which is what AI is. It's regurgitating pre-existing content. And so the audiences seem to be responding to all those superhero franchise movies and whatnot. And I think you're right. That's a complaint that people have about content that is feeling formulaic. It just would probably get worse. I mean, there's nothing to keep them from, say, taking the 40 story beats of Save the Cat, sticking it into AI and saying, this is going to be the basis of every screenplay that we ever do. And so what may seem formulaic now, I think, be even worse in the future.
What is Save the Cat?
Save the Cat's the most popular screenwriting book out there. It's was written by a screenwriter back in the, I think, 90s. And it's, I think, no knock on the writer, no disrespect, he was a screenwriter, that it has led to many people thinking that you can reduce story to these 40 story beats. And so we have a lot of formulaic content being generated by writers using that and other various paradigms. So if you fed that into AI and sort of got rid of the human component, then it would be even more sort of formulaic content being created.
So I guess who's to blame for this? Because it's easy to blame the suits for just going back to a winning formula over and over again because they're really concerned about their bottom line and satisfying their shareholders. But what about writers who could be lazy maybe and are turning in scripts that are formulaic and not interesting?
There's nothing to keep them from doing that. There's nothing to keep any writer from using ChatGPT right now. And I'm sure there are writers that are doing it. Yeah. The problem is, like, when I'm working with it just recently, doing these tests, yes, does it understand scene construction, like beginning, middle, and end? Yes. It can even understand irony. It can understand, like, plot twists. But as soon as you get into the arena of what human beings, actual characters, are about in terms of dialogue and nuance and complexity, it's just nowhere near where it needs to be. I started this whole thing when Aaron Sorkin did an event recently, and someone asked him, did they think whether AI could write an episode of West Wing? And Aaron Sorkin said, no, I think you're going to enjoy things done by humans more. Well, it remains to be seen, but I did do a test where I asked ChatGPT to write a West Wing episode, and it was really very, very bad. I mean, just not good at all.
You did several experiments. You had them write in the style of David Lynch, who happens to be our KCRW weatherman. Also, M. Night Shyamalan, the suspense horror filmmaker. And were those more successful?
Not sounding like, but for example, the M. Night Shyamalan thing, he's The Sixth Sense. So he's become very famous for, like, these big twists at the end, these big surprises. And so I explored that with ChatGPT, and it did actually understand that, where they had a scenario where they had twists at the end. When I did an Indiana Jones one and asked it to provide some of that kind of humor that Indiana Jones would have, it was really ridiculous. I mean, it was like a fourth grader had written it. So again, once you move into the human arena, it just, it's not there yet. Now, of course, it's changing all the time. So who knows? Maybe it will be there at some point.
Well, obviously, other people are concerned in Hollywood about artificial intelligence, like actors, especially voice actors, directors. What about studio executives or lower level executives? Could AI be used to replace some of what they do?
Well, that's exactly a point I made the other day. was that there's no reason in the world, like, for example, you could take those 40 story beats from Save the Cat, stick it in ChatGPT or AI, and just say, okay, lower level studio executive, we no longer need you. We're just going to have that AI interact with the writer. And so you're gone. Actors, same thing, voiceover actors. I mean, this is potentially going to impact everything. This all goes to this idea of optimization, which is to, you know, minimize expense and maximize profitability. And they see this, I think, as a means to that end.
What do you think is the best way for writers to fight back and to try to prevent this from happening, if that's possible?
The strike is the first place to go. I mean, the Writers Guild, you could look back on this historically and say this was hopefully a turning point where humans basically stood up and said, we need to put some parameters here, some fencing on this, because this is potentially, it could eradicate what we've come to know as like a writing career in Hollywood, but beyond that, just the impact of workers everywhere. So I'd say, you know, be aware of the writer's strike and support it as best you can, because it is, I think, on the front edge of this controversy.
Scott Myers has been a WGA member since 1987. He now teaches screenwriting at DePaul University in Chicago, and he writes the blog Go Into the Story for the Blacklist website. Scott, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, AI could never replace KCRW, or could it? That sounds like the plot of a screenplay. Not a very good one, though. And so I'm speaking to you live. This is obviously not an AI speaking to you. Trying to get you to save our summer. Help us save our summer, because we are having this emergency fundraiser during the summer. We don't normally do this, and we don't like to do this. We don't like fundraising, but we have to do it because this is the way we support ourselves. And our revenue has been down. This is happening across the board in media. And so we need to come to you for a little extra sauce. Save our summer at 800-600-KCRW. KCRW.com/give. We have, you know, our usual swag, also some new stuff for this fundraiser. So go check that out at the website at KCRW.com. And this is really exciting. Anyone who gives monthly at $20 gets an extra special gift. You get two limited edition lip balms with custom KCRW flavors. There's Cherry Glazer and Morning Becomes Matcha. And that's from EXO, the LA-based maker of clean and ethical flavored lip balm. So get your lips moisturized and give us some sauce here at KCRW. KCRW.com/give. And thank you. Coming up, we will have your weekend movie reviews, including the latest animated Spider-Man film.
There's a Spider-Punk character played by Daniel Kaluuya, and he constantly looks like he's ripped off of like a punk rock flyer. He's kind of rumpled and strange looking.
All right, that's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Thursday. And if you are a KCRW listener, lover, and hopefully supporter, you know what that means. It's time for this week's film reviews. Joining us today is Whitney Seibold, contributor to Slash Film and co-host of the podcast Critically Acclaimed. And Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service, the LA Times, and The Wrap. Welcome, both of you.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right, let's start with Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. This takes place over a year after the events of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. This time, Spider-Man Miles is called upon to save spider people from someone or something called the Spot.
My name is Miles Morales. I'm Brooklyn's one and only Spider-Man. And things are going great.
Oh, yeah. You were supposed to be here at 5.
All right, whatever.
Whatever?
Wow.
Whatever?
Okay, Whitney, there is definitely a lot of anticipation for this movie because, well, everyone seemed to love the first one. What did you think?
Well, Into the Spider-Verse was an incredible film. It was just so striking and stylish. It's like the filmmakers remembered that animation was kind of this limitless medium. So they just threw as many weird colors and shapes and ideas at the audience as they could. And with this new film, Across the Spider-Verse, they've just decided to up the visual game. So it is just bigger and longer. There are more spider people from more alternate universes. That's the premise of these movies, is the multiverse is broken open and spider people, men, women, and animals from all across the multiverse can now meet and interact. The antagonist is a villain called The Spot, but the other antagonist is a Spider-Man from the year 2099 who wishes to make sure spider people continue to be created. And the big moral quandary is, if you're going to create a spider person, doesn't that mean an Uncle Ben has to die for each one? So now there's this raft of dead Uncle Bens across the multiverse that Miles Morales begins to question whether or not that's necessary. A lot of the sort of moral questions and story beats are kind of intriguing, and you're going to be so unbelievably dazzled by some of these visuals. There's a villain in it that looks like he came out of a Leonardo da Vinci sketchbook, for instance. Mm. There's a spider punk character played by Daniel Kaluuya, and he constantly looks like he's ripped off of like a punk rock flyer. He's kind of rumpled and strange looking. It does become a little bit much after a while. Visually, it's wonderful, but in terms of story and twists, it begins to pile on after a while. The movie is over 2 hours in length, which is unusual for an animated feature. This is actually only one half of a two-part mega sequel, so it's difficult for me to criticize it properly because I feel like it's not finished. They introduced all of these interesting ideas and they didn't really follow through yet. So this isn't a matter of a cliffhanger. They didn't finish up story things. It feels like they didn't even complete the ideas. They didn't complete anything within this chapter. So now we're going to have to wait until, I believe, the next chapter comes out in March to figure out what this film was all about.
Oh my gosh. So another 2 hours, but maybe worth it. Katie, what did you think?
Yeah, this is a 2 hour and 20 minute movie, and it feels like a blur of color and light. I couldn't believe that it was over as quickly as it was. It just goes by in such a flash. It's an incredibly immersive visual experience. I do recommend sitting very close to the screen, although I'm sure it's amazing if you sit farther back too. I was just very close, and I just felt like I fell into this pool of incredible artwork and character. I felt like there was sort of references to abstract expressionism and, you know, dance and all of these different art forms that we've, you know, seen over the years. But you still are able to hold on to these characters, specifically Miles Morales, who is sort of deciding, is he going to write his own story or is he going to, you know, be adherent to the text, the canon, if you will. But I also love that this story also really focuses a lot on his friend Gwen, who plays Ghost Spider and is voiced by Hailee Steinfeld. And she gets a whole storyline as well, too. So the fact that they're able to manage so many characters and themes and the artistry of it all is really impressive. I just love these movies.
Do you recommend going in an altered state, given all the visual stimulation? Or maybe the opposite?
The movie, you know, does it for you, I'd say.
I would be a little overwhelmed, I think, if I was not fully with all of my senses and faculties.
Okay. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse is in wide release today. Next, we have past lives. In this one, two childhood friends are torn apart when one of the families emigrates from South Korea to Canada. They are reunited as adults.
What a good story this is. Childhood sweethearts who reconnect 20 years later and realize they were meant for each other. In the story, I would be the evil white American husband standing in the way of destiny.
Shut up.
All right, Katie, we interviewed the director of this yesterday, Celine Song, and talked a lot about it. So if anyone missed that, they can go back and listen to that. But what did you think of this movie? And give everyone a quick summary of the plot.
Yeah, this is the directorial debut of Celine Song. It's based, I believe, on a incident from her own life about a young girl who at the age of 12 immigrates from Korea to Canada with her family and leaves behind a very close friend, a young boy who, you know, they sort of have crush on each other, and they reconnect as sort of in their early 20s and have this sort of obsessive friendship via Skype. And then that kind of falls away, and then they reconnect again when they're in their mid 30s. And she at this point is married, and he comes to visit New York where she's living. And it sort of takes place over a couple of days of them kind of exploring, you know, what this connection is. But it's also about fate. I love this film because of the way that Celine Song treats time. And the story is about time. It's about flashes of memory and 12 years and 24 years, but then also 2 minutes. And she's very patient in the way that she treats some of these moments. There's just, she will just show two characters waiting for a car for 2 minutes. And there's so much tension and all of these things that are left unsaid between these characters, but we are willing to sort of sit there in this moment as the clock is ticking. I think that it really ties into the theme of all of these lifetimes and all of these moments of, you know, fate that bring people together and the kind of randomness or fatedness of the world. I also think it's just really beautifully shot. Shabir Kirchner is a DP, and they shot on 35 millimeter, and it's just an incredibly warm, sort of grainy, beautiful film that you just kind of want to take in certain shots and scenes that kind of, you're like, I don't even know why there's a shot of like a water glass and a lemon, but I love it and I can't stop thinking about it. So it's just a really beautiful, beautifully crafted and excellently acted film. Greta Lee is the lead character here. Tae Yoo, it plays her Korean friend, Hae-sung, and he's an amazing actor. I think he really kind of brings the mood and sentiment of this film to the fore. And John Magaro plays her husband, Arthur. And they're just such a great trio. I just think you rarely see a film that's made with as much patience and care as this film. And I just think it's really special.
I agree. And I think what I really loved about it, too, is that she doesn't fall into an expected trap when it comes to a trio and romantic connections and who's going to get together with whom and etc. I think that there's it's an interesting complexity that isn't often explored in these kinds of movies. So
yes,
I loved it as well.
Great. Two thumbs up.
Four thumbs up. Four. Past Lives in theaters beginning today. Next up, we have a supernatural horror film. It's called The Boogeyman. It's based on a 1973 short story of the same name by Stephen King about a high school student struggling with her mother's death.
So this light is going to be completely solid like it is right now. And gradually, it's going to start flashing until it's totally dark. So you can see that there's nothing to be afraid of. Okay.
All right. So, Whitney, you saw this one. Sophie Thatcher plays the high school student, Sadie Harper. And what did you think of this one?
It doesn't do anything new, The Boogeyman. It is based on a story that was written in the 70s. Maybe that's why it has a bit of an old-fashioned quality to it. But more than anything, it just does a really predictable story relatively well. The filmmaker, his name is Rob Savage, previously did a movie called Host from a couple of years ago, and that was a haunting movie that was set entirely on a Zoom call and how the ghost was moving from caller to caller as they were on this this computer screen. And it was released right during the height of the pandemic when everyone was locked in. That one was really novel. That one was really clever. I wish he had brought some of that cleverness to something like The Boogeyman, which feels like his Hollywood experiment. This is him doing something completely pat, completely mainstream, well enough, but not terribly interesting.
All right, The Boogeyman in theaters beginning today. Last up, we have a sports drama called Shooting Stars about basketball star LeBron James, based on the book by LeBron and Buzz Bissinger, who was the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Friday Night Lights. Here's a bit from the trailer.
See you second, Coach.
You on the team here?
Nah, but I could be if you lucky. Me and my boys, we've been balling with each other since we was like 10. Call ourselves the Fab Four.
Let's go then! Get up!
Can win you a state championship, guaranteed.
All right, Katie, the stars Marquise Mookie Cook as LeBron. It's his debut as an actor, but he is a basketball player at the University of Oregon. How is he?
He should stick to his day job.
Oh, dear.
Uh-oh. I'm sorry to say. So this is about LeBron James and his four best friends in high school. There was a documentary in 2008 called More Than a Game, which is about this same story. A very well-received documentary. So they have since basically made this documentary, but they're also adapting the book into this high school sports varied sort of generic, the team wins the game kind of story. I don't think this movie needed to be made at all, and it is not very good. I will say that Wood Harris, who we know from The Wire as Avon Barksdale, plays Drew Joyce, who's the coach, the beloved coach of LeBron James, and Caleb McLaughlin from Stranger Things plays his son, Little Drew, who's one of LeBron's friends. And there's some tension there because he really wants to be a basketball star. And it just is so obvious that LeBron is the star here and his friends are the supporting characters. But those guys are great. Caleb and Wood Harris are great. But the rest of the cast is just like not picking up the slack. And I also think that the direction by Chris Robinson is just not all that interesting either. I think he really over relies on needle drops. I just think there are a few needle drops that and songs that you can use that are sort of like cheat codes. I almost wanted to be like, foul, you can't use that song. And he lets the whole song play. I was like kind of shocked. But if you put Outkast over a basketball game, it's going to be exciting. It just like it
seems
it's
like a
not
cheap
even
trick,
a question.
Though.
Yeah. So, and he does some interesting things with drones and stuff in the basketball games, but it didn't really feel like there was an organizing principle to how he was shooting the basketball games. He was kind of just doing some cool shots, but it wasn't like there was a thesis behind why he was doing any of what he was doing. It's just very generic and not that compelling. I'm so sorry to say.
Oh my gosh. Okay, should we skip that and watch the NBA finals, Whitney?
Yes.
And Katie? Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
Sorry.
Watching an actual basketball game is more dramatic than this movie. I'm not really sure what the arc or the story or the thrust or even the point was. It seems that LeBron James was once a teenager and he played a lot of basketball when he was a teenager and he had a good time with his friends.
How did that happen?
The whole point of the movie. There's a scene early in the film where they go to basketball training, they come home and they play more basketball at home, and then they play video games and they're basketball video games. That's all they have in their lives is basketball. And they have a good time doing it and they like doing it as friends. And I guess if you just sort of want to hang out with a teenage LeBron James, that's the reason of this movie. It's a hangout kind of a movie, but it's not warm or comforting or fun because it does have some of these really cliched, really boring sort of sport movie moments that you've seen done better in thousands of other sports movies. I'm not really sure why we need this.
Oh my God. First he loses to the Nuggets and now this? 0-2, LeBron.
This year, we've had two films about the stars of the two Space Jam movies, because Michael Jordan had Air.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know how you feel about Air, but...
I enjoyed Air, but that's a subject for another day.
It certainly is. Okay, we'll throw down on that one. All right. Shooting Stars streaming if you want, or again, you can watch the NBA Finals beginning tomorrow on Peacock. And that is it for this week. Whitney Seibold, contributor to Slash Film and co-host of the podcast Critically Acclaimed. Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service, the LA Times, and The Wrap. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You are listening to KCRW during our first day of our Save Our Summer emergency fundraiser. I'm joined now by Steve Chiotakis for a little help in trying to get you to go online or go to the phone to up your membership or become a new member or renew your membership, whatever it is, 800-600-5279 or kcrw.com/join. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Madeline. Just imagine you and I are both on a secluded beach, right? And we're on this island, and
hopefully it's sunny because it's not really sunny right now.
Well, I mean, it's not June gloom, but I mean, really. So we've got the rocks, and we've got SOS, and we're waving at you. You're up in the airplane, and we're waving at you. Come help us. We're trying to make sure that the radio station stays strong and healthy going forward, and we call it our Save Our Summer campaign because this is one way to do it. Just a few days out of the summer, we're asking for your support to be a part of this radio station, active participant in the radio station to keep us strong and healthy going forward, because things, as you know, Madeline Brand, are very expensive these days.
They certainly are. Inflation is a real thing, and also so are media layoffs and media bankruptcies. That's also a real thing that's happening everywhere. So let us not have that befall us, and it's not going to, but that's because we have great listeners like you supporting us. KCRW.com/join. Thank you, Steve.
All right.
Coming up, Evan Kleiman is here with a recipe for summer. That is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb chop?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom, flames.
Bam, that's a little bam right there.
Pie.
When it's hot outside, there is nothing better than reaching for a refreshing cold drink. Evan Kleiman is here with two delicious drink recipes. She is host of KCRW's Good Food. Hi.
Hi.
All right. You're taking us to India and to Brazil. Two hot places.
So they know how to keep cool, and they both grow a lot of limes. So both of these cold drinks that we're going to talk about today use fresh lime juice as the main ingredient.
Okay. Let's begin in India.
So with India, we're looking at Nimbupani, which is basically limeade. It's lime juice, water, ice, and then there's a collection of optional spices and a funky black salt called Kala Namak, which, oh, I love. It's so delicious. It's got a little sourness. And so the drink is balanced between sweet and sour, depending on personal taste.
Kala Namak. Where would you get Kala Namak?
At any Indian sweet and spices store, of which there are many in our fair town.
Yeah. Okay. And so tell us how this is made.
I mean, it's really easy. You can do it two different ways. You can make an individual glass. You can make a pitcher. Or if you're having quite a few people out, you can kind of set it out so that people can customize their own. So what I like to do is start out with a fairly basic limeade that isn't too sweet and isn't too sour with ice in it. And then around that, I have more lime juice, simple syrup, so it will melt quickly instead of just putting in granular sugar. And then I'll have cumin, chaat masala, which is a spice mixture that has dried mango in it, amchur in it, so it has more sourness and is complex and absolutely delicious and addictive. And this salt, this black salt, and then some regular salt if you want. And that way people can customize it.
And the salt is good because when you sweat, a lot of the salt comes out of your body.
It's like making your own really delicious electrolyte drink.
Yeah, that sounds so delicious. And do you use sparkling water?
You could use sparkling water, but the traditional way is to just use fresh water. I think it's more thirst quenching that way because you can really power it back.
Chug it, in other words.
Yeah.
Okay, so that drink is called Nimbu Pani from India. And now let's go to Brazil. You have a recipe for Brazilian lemonade, but made from limes.
This is a drink that's been all over TikTok for a couple of years. So it's gotten more popular. It is a drink that is made sweet with sweetened condensed milk, which gives it this creamy luxuriousness. And it's also made an unusual way in that you use the whole lime, not just the juice. So what you do is you you blend the cut up lime up with water, the whole lime, pulsing it a few times. You strain out the lime particles, and then you take that limey water, which is now infused with all those lime zest oils, so it's quite bright, back into the blender. You add a bit of sugar if you really have a sweet tooth, in addition to the sweetened condensed milk, and you whiz it up. And that drink can sit in the fridge for quite a while and be absolutely fine. If you're going to serve it, then you want to put it back in the blender, add some ice cubes to it, and then get it really frothy and slushy.
That sounds really good. But how does the milk not curdle with all that lime?
I know. Well, this is why people use sweetened condensed milk. It's, you know, because it's so stabilized, it won't curdle.
Ah, okay. That sounds so good. Sweet and sour.
Oh, it's so good.
Sounds like a dessert, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Almost. I mean, it's really, really nice.
Rich.
The one thing you need to be careful of is when you blend up the whole limes, you have to be careful not to keep them in the blender too long, because the longer the lime goes through those cutting blades, the more bitter it will be. Mm. So you just want to pulse it a few times.
I guess you could add some rum and make it a pina colada.
Oh my gosh. I mean, any, both of these drinks actually make an incredible base for a cocktail. The Nimbu Pani with gin is amazing. And the Brazilian limonada, if you add the cachaça, perfect.
Sounds perfect. I'm almost waiting for it to be unbearably hot so I can have these drinks. What is on Good Food this week?
Thanks for asking, Madeline. Some of the segments we're going to have on the show this weekend include talking about an essay that a local food writer, Jean Trin, wrote, and she actually has been nominated for a James Beard Award. It's such an interesting story about how her parents' Chinese donut business helped save the family when they were refugees. Then we talked to teacher and cookbook author Andrea Nguyen, who has a lesson for cooking Vietnamese dishes at home. And LA Times restaurant critic Bill Addison visits a restaurant in Alhambra for Chinese comfort food. And of course, Jen Farrow is going to be joining me to try and convince people to pledge to the show.
All right, you can hear that on Saturday mornings at 10 or wherever you get your podcasts. Evan Kleiman, host of KSRB's Good Food, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, you don't have to wait till tomorrow to pledge to KSRB. You can do it right now at kcrw.com/give, 800-600-5279. It's June 1 and the first day of our summer fundraiser. We're calling it Save Our Summer, SOS. We don't usually come to you at this time of the year, but we need to because this is just the way it is right now in the media world. Our revenues are down and we need to come to you to ask you to help us keep it going on and support the personalities like Evan Kleiman that you love and that you've been listening to for years and years and years and getting great tips and recipes and food news from her and also getting all the news and culture here on Press Play and the other shows. that we produce here at KCRW. It costs money to produce them. We have producers who need to eat as well, and we need to pay them a living wage. KCRW.com/give. That's where we do it. That's where you become a part of the community. And we thank you so much, so much for your support. Thank you also for listening to Press Play this week. That'll do it for our shows. And we'll be back, of course, on Monday. Our producers are Brian Hartzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, Nihar Patel, Marcel Hutchins, and Rebecca Ludman. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Ta is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our fabulous managing producer. And our technical director is the ever super Mario Saavedra. You're super too. KCRW.com/give. Thank you and have a fantastic weekend.